Welcome everyone to the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, where we speak to interesting and knowledgeable people about how best to protect sentient beings from the harms of coming into existence. I am your host, John, an antinatalist advocate from the UK, and I'll be the main host of the podcast going forward. There are a few ideas that influence my thoughts and actions more than antinatalism and effective altruism. I'm fascinated about how these different concepts or worldviews, both focused on making the world a better place, are related to each other and what this means for the individuals and communities who identify with these ideas. I really wanted to do a deep dive on both when we started this podcast back in July. Now, last time out on episode 2, we spoke with Amanda Old van Suikernick about antinatalism both as a philosophy and a community, and it seemed only fitting, therefore, to have a similar episode introducing effective altruism. Just needed to find someone within the EA community who is knowledgeable about antinatalism, and I couldn't think of a better person to fit the bill than Michael, aka Vegan Space Scientist. Michael works as a strategy lead and researcher at the Sentience Institute, which is a non-profit dedicated to expanding moral consideration for sentient beings. You'll probably know him best from his YouTube channel, Vegan Space Scientist, where he makes videos on a wide range of topics, including animal rights, physics, and recently his experiences in getting a vasectomy. He certainly walks the walk when it comes to not having children. Michael is a long-term vegan and holds a PhD in space science, which is how his YouTube channel got the name, and his impact-focused approach to doing good in the world has certainly been very inspiring for me and many others, which is why we were really grateful to have Michael on the show. Now, Michael is an Australian, which means I had to get up at an ungodly hour to record this podcast, given the time difference between me being based in the UK and him over in Australia. Now, both me and my laptop were a little slow to wake up that morning, which made it difficult for me to operate the controls on the podcast recording software. As such, at the beginning and end of the podcast, I sound quite robotic and clunky as I was trying to fumble around looking for the record button, so you can have a good laugh at that as you listen. Anyway, without further ado, I bring you episode 3 of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast with Michael, Vegan Space Scientist. Enjoy. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. And welcome to you, Michael, Vegan Space Scientist. It's great to have you.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. So, as pretty much every podcast begins, would you like to start with a bit of an introduction to yourself?
Sure. Happy to. So, I guess start with what I'm doing at the moment. So, mostly the main thing I'm doing at the moment is working for Sentience Institute, which is an effective altruism aligned think tank, working as a researcher and also strategy lead. So doing a lot of ops, things like hiring, fundraising, grant writing, all the other behind the scenes charity stuff, but then also working some research projects like thinking about long-termism as it applies to the animal protection movement, for example.
Great. Well, yeah, I was going to ask, so what kind of does the day-to-day role of a researcher look like? Just as interested as someone who's had that job title before, but I understand it's quite different depending on where you work.
Yeah, sure. So it could be like just researching and writing either blog posts or papers, which we do a lot. I often spend a lot of time giving feedback on my colleagues' work as well. So we working in Google Docs and giving feedback and reviewing each other's work. Yeah, I guess that's the main day-to-day. But then the ops work takes up a lot of my day-to-day as well.
Yeah, as you said, like hiring, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Great. So how did you become interested in antinatalism?
Yeah, so I found out what the term antinatalist meant in 2016. I'd never really heard it before then. So I would have been about 24 at the time. But I've never wanted a kid for my entire life. So I guess you could say I was always antinatalist. I just didn't know what the term was. There's never been a point, I think, even from a very young age, I was pretty much just adamant that I'm never going to have a child. And I think the reasons for that have kind of been added to over time. So initially as a kid, it was more so that I didn't want to for, I guess, like you could say personal reasons or maybe selfish reasons. Mm-hmm. Just the thought of having a child seemed like not a fun time, not something that I wanted to do. But then over time, I think that got bolstered with more ethical arguments for not having a child. And then coinciding around 2016 when I found out about the philosophy and the movement of antinatalism and realized that that pretty much describes me.
This is a bit of a side note, but I've heard antinatalists being criticized for choosing a philosophy that matches the lifestyle that they would like to have. And this is something I said in my first interview on Lawrence Anton's channel, was that when I was 25, I was already vegan. I was thinking of not having a kid just so that I could save money to donate to charity if I did want to have this positive impact. I know it's something we'll get to later. And also, my long-term girlfriend has never wanted a kid, never had any kind of like maternal instinct. And then I discovered antinatalism. And I wonder, is that a problem? Does that like weaken the position in some way?
So I think it's good to be aware of, because I mean, you can experience this in effective altruism as well, where sometimes people might get criticized for like coming up with the ethical justification for what they want to do after the fact, where it could be the other way around. I don't think it's always a problem though, because it could just be that you know, you got lucky and the thing that you want to do turns out to also be the right thing. Something that we should kind of check, I guess, and be aware of, because there's probably a lot of times when there's something that we do that, you know, could turn out to not be the right thing. And we have to be open to that being the possibility and changing our mind on that.
Absolutely.
It's just a challenge.
And that's my approach as well. Is like, I think it's good to have a healthy degree of skepticism with your own reasoning, because it's really easy, as you're saying, to reason your way into doing what you want to do. But of course, this wouldn't just apply for antinatalism, as you say. It would apply for having children as well, I think.
Exactly,
some people really want to have kids, and then they reason their way into it being a good thing to do as well.
Yeah. On that note, I will say I really sympathize with people who want to have kids but come to the conclusion that it would be ethical to do so. I guess it doesn't feel like there's many of those people, but I have met a few, and you know, some of them go on to say that they won't have a child, even though that's something they kind of want to do for the selfish reasons. So, I mean, I'm lucky, I guess, that that's not me, but I do sympathize with that. I mean, I'm sure that would be extremely challenging.
Absolutely. And you meet antinatalist parents, you meet people who really did want to have children. I think I was more in the camp of, if I was really convinced by an ethical argument, like I probably would have had kids in the end, but I wasn't someone who had that desire. I wasn't thinking about the lifestyle I would want. And for those people who really do want to have that lifestyle and then, then refrain from that, take a different path for ethical reasons, I'm just full of admiration for those people. Yeah. Sure.
Definitely.
How did you become interested in veganism? Is that of interest? Because obviously you have the YouTube channel, Vegan Space Scientist.
Yeah, that's right. So I had never met a vegan until I started going to university. And my best friend was vegan. So I...
vegan.
Yes. And I pestered him with a lot of questions because I'd never met one. I don't think I'd even... I probably hadn't heard the term before, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I was aware of what a vegetarian was, but I haven't really met many of them either. But you know, when he came into my house, he wouldn't have any animal products, and I was very much not vegetarian at the time. So I asked a lot of questions, and I think I was like probably a bit of a pest in hindsight, but like I was like somewhat well-intentioned. I mean, I was like genuinely curious, but probably, you know, if someone asked me questions like that today, I might get maybe a little bit annoyed after the 100th question. But no, they were very, very happy to answer my questions and very like calm and told me, you know, their like rationale and explained to me like there are foods that you can eat. It's not like you're going to starve and only lettuce and salad. So I think eventually he kind of just wore me down with logic. So after about 2 years, I said, okay, well, I'll try vegetarian for a week. Look, it's probably going to be really hard. I'll give it a go. I'll try it for a week. I'll do this, you know, because it's probably the right thing to do. And I just never stopped because it turned out to be pretty easy. And then after 2 more years of that, I went vegan. I tried vegan for a week and then never stopped again. And that was about 8 years ago now. So in hindsight, I mean, I probably should have done it. I definitely should have done it. I could have done it, I guess, what I'm trying to say. Like so much earlier, it just wasn't as hard as I was making it out to be in my mind. I think I like had the inclination to do it probably years before I actually went and did it.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, there's a lot of cultural baggage you need to get over to make that step. Yeah. I definitely could have gone vegan earlier. It's been about 7 years for me. But yeah, I think that's a great example of how, obviously as vegans, we hear the same annoying questions, the same excuses over and over and over again. But for the people who are putting those questions to us, this might genuinely be the first time that they've asked someone or heard a different opinion on this. And I think your friend is a great example of how, like, the patience and kindness and empathy and just answering the questions in goodwill, how that can have a really positive impact and ultimately,
convert
more people to the vegan cult.
Mm. Yeah, they're more patient than I am, I think. I aspire to be.
Yeah, no, I was about to say, I'm saying, I know that this is logically the right approach, but yeah, I definitely, sometimes I run out of patience with those kind of questions. But yeah, I guess, how did you become, so antinatalist at 24, how old were you when you went vegan?
Just no interest. Yeah, I always think about this in terms of like the year, but I went, so I guess probably like 21, I want to say. 21, yeah. Maybe 22, but a few years before antinatalist. And then I think I discovered effective altruism actually around the same time as I went vegan.
Yeah. Interesting. So yeah, how did you first come across effective altruism?
Yeah, so I think for a little while before I came across it, I was already starting to think about, I think the first thing that kind of got me motivated to do something kind of on a grand scale was like, I found out about climate change through my university degree studying climate change. Wanted to do something about that. That was part of the motivation for me to become vegetarian initially. I guess I was already thinking about problems in the world in kind of like a scientific, like utilitarian-esque way. I mean, I was thinking about things like, how can I do the most good? And I have some obligation to do good because I'm in a good opportunity, in a good position, have an opportunity to do good.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it didn't feel like there were many people who thought about that the same way as I did, at least those around me. And I guess a good example is after my degree and before I started my first full-time job, I'd organized to join a group of other people from a charity in Australia, volunteer and go to Nepal for 6 weeks to help build a hospital. So, you know, I paid my own way to go there. And I was kind of in this position where my job told me, I told them what I was doing and they said, okay, fine. You can start work whenever you want. Like, we don't care if you start work now. We don't care if you start work in 6 weeks when you get back, all good. So my like scientific brain started to think about, well, if I start my job 6 weeks earlier, then, you know, it's a pretty well-paid job. I would have enough money to fund like 2 more people to go on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could go myself. And I thought, well, you know, is it better for me to just start my job earlier and not do this, even though like it's something I've really wanted to do, like to get hands-on and to help people. And I think I'd like express that kind of anguish I was having to a few people around me, family and some friends, and they all thought I was crazy. They thought it was like massively overthinking it, being really I'm not sure if obnoxious is the right word, but you know, they really pushed back on it. And eventually I was convinced to like go on this trip myself, and I did, and came back six weeks later and started working. But just after I came back, I came across Peter Singer's TED talk about effective altruism. Mm-hmm. And it kind of all clicked. I was like, wow, okay, like I'm not completely crazy. There are people in the world who think this way about charity and about doing good. Kind of take the like scientific, cold and rational approach. So I ended up emailing Peter Singer. Peter Singer being, if people are not aware, like one of the founding fathers of effective altruism, also very involved in animal rights movement in the from the 70s onwards. So I emailed him and asked, how can I get involved in effective altruism? I was living in Adelaide at the time in South Australia. And he suggested I just start a chapter, like a local chapter of effective altruism. So he put me in touch with someone else who was moving from the already active Melbourne chapter to move to Adelaide. And I just got involved through that, like helped to start the Adelaide chapter, became really involved. And then when I moved to Sydney a few years after that, then I became involved in the Sydney chapter as well.
Great. So your first interaction with an effective altruist was with none other than Peter Singer.
Yeah, I guess it was, yeah. And it was really... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, if he's not quite the founding father, he definitely is the, well, the person who inspired the movement with some of his writings. And again, like, he talks about them in that excellent TED Talk. I know exactly the clip that you mean.
Yeah.
Be sure to include all this in the link underneath the podcast. That's so cool that you reached out to him.
I wasn't really expecting a reply, to be honest. I thought it was like quite a long shot. He was like pretty well-known guy. I thought he was very important and busy. He ended up actually replying. I think I watched the video and I sent the email at like 11 p.m. really excitedly. He ended up responding within a few hours and it went to my spam email. Which I don't normally check, but I happened to check it that day. So if I didn't check it, I might have forever missed the email from Peter Singer.
That's cool. Maybe he liked you as a fellow Australian, you know.
Maybe, yeah.
Good to see some EA in Australia. thank you for sharing that. And I think that's such an interesting story. Someone who, like, there is a bit of a culture in the UK as well of like wealthy Westerners volunteering abroad. And I definitely got caught up in that after university, in the year after uni. And I now do look back and think, man, I spent a lot of money on flights and accommodation, and you know, I did have a wonderful time. But then, yeah, when I've expressed these concerns afterwards, people said, oh, you're being selfish, you had this amazing experience. And I said, well, I did really have a great experience. But I think, yeah, going forward, like taking that cold hard approach of, okay, if I really want to do good, then, as you said, you have to kind of crunch the numbers to some extent and really focus on the most good. And that ties in perfectly to my next question, which is going to be like, what are the basic ideas behind EA or effective altruism? EA obviously being the acronym. Basic ideas behind effective altruism as a philosophy.
Yeah, sure. So I like to think of effective altruism as a question. It's about asking the right question. It's not really prescriptive per se, because people do disagree on like what the answer is to the question. But I think the question is just, how can we do the most good with our limited time and money? And in some ways, it's as simple as that. Now, people might disagree on the ethical framework to like run with that for that question. I mean, some, you know, there are most people, I guess, in the air movement are utilitarian, but not everyone. So in some ways,
utilitarian being that good and bad actions are based upon outcomes, and a good action is one that produces lots of happiness or well-being, and a bad one's the one that produces lots of like unhappiness or pain, suffering, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and that's how we judge our moral decisions, rather than like a rules-based deontological approach, which is more like rights-based, isn't it?
Yeah. Thanks for that explainer. So. Yeah, I guess in some ways it's a little bit neutral to that. It's just really about like, however you want to do good, how do you do the most good? We have limited time and money. We can't solve all the problems in the world, and there are so many, but how can we do as much good as we can? So from that, you've got, I guess, thinking about like, what can we do with our money? Where can we give our money or start projects? As effectively as possible, but then also thinking about like, what does that mean? How do we even know what charities to support? So I guess this gets a little bit away from philosophy per se. It's like more practical, but ultimately it's just about that. And I think a lot of people disagree on exactly how to do that. Even when people have the same ethical framework, they might disagree on like specifically what does that mean? What does it imply for like how we should live our lives? But I think that's the general principle. And I think most, if not everyone in EA, can agree with that.
And I think that's a really helpful way of like conceptualizing of EA, because certainly from the outside, a lot of people can get bogged down in those practical recommendations, people might be like, oh, EA is all about malaria nets, or EA is all about being terrified of AI and the Terminator scenario.
And I
think that was a good point that you made, just as a nerdy philosophy point, that it doesn't have to be, like, you don't have to take that utilitarian approach to EA. Like, if your morals are not based on maximizing well-being and preventing suffering, if it is a more justice approach or a rights-based approach, EA would just be the approach of, okay, if you want to protect people's rights or stop infringements of rights, whatever that may be, just taking a practical approach to make sure you're doing as much of that good as possible, using reason and evidence.
I
agree. I totally... And that's something that we will go into a bit later, like the distinction between EA as a philosophy or an idea and EA as a community, is that I strongly believe you can separate the two. And certainly with what Lawrence and I are trying to do with antinatalist advocacy is to really look at the kind of EA ideas or EA approach. I still think that approach is really, really good, even if I do have some criticisms of the community, which we'll definitely get to later.
Thing I think I might be worth adding just there quickly, and another thing that might be a bit counterintuitive, but it's important to kind of apply EA to when you're doing good, even if you're pretty sure that what you're doing is good, because sometimes our actions can have unintended consequences. So I mean, there are some examples of charities that have been very well intentioned but for whatever reason have actually backfired and cause more harm than good. And so, you know, if that can happen to charities, it can happen to our own individual actions too. So we should be trying to, I guess, take a step back and make sure that what we're doing is doing good and is doing the most good that we can.
Absolutely. And just to pick an example from my own life, the volunteering schemes that I went on in my early 20s, I really did feel like I was doing a lot of good, and there's a lot of positive reinforcement when I was there that I was doing good. And maybe, you know, with some of the work that I did, I do genuinely believe that I did some small amount of good. It was an incredibly costly amount of good because I flew to the other side of the world and lived there and paid for my accommodation or whatever. So it was an incredibly costly thing to do, but there was more positive feedback when I was on those schemes compared to me setting up a direct debit for charity that just leaves my account every month. And that's why it's always good to, as you're saying, like to stop and ask yourself, is this the most good that I'm doing? Like, what is this based upon? Is this based upon as close to an objective look at the evidence as possible, or are there some other things going on here? Because I think for all of us in our own lives, we can look at actions that we've taken to do good that may have done some good, sometimes may have even actually done some harm, and then recognizing that those aren't the optimal actions for us to take if we really do want to have that approach of doing the most good possible. How would you say that these ideas have kind of changed or evolved over time? Because it is still quite a young philosophy. I think only maybe 15 years ago that these ideas came to prominence.
Well, I think the ideas have maybe been around a little bit longer, but I guess the term and the maybe community of effective altruism, probably 2009 is when they started. But I think Peter Singer wrote an essay, I might forget the name, Famine, Affluence and Morality. I believe
That would definitely be getting linked below. That's like the iconic.
At least a few decades old now, and I think like some of the initial ideas were there, and it's not, I you know, probably other people throughout history have thought similar things. But as a movement and as a very tightly defined philosophy, it's still relatively young, maybe 15 years. So how's that evolved over that time? As a philosophy, we can talk about maybe how it's evolved as a community after, but specifically as a philosophy, I think initially effective altruism was mostly focused on global health as a cause area. And to let your listeners know what I mean by cause area, so like a whole kind of category of like a problem. So you could think of like global health and maybe international development as one. But then there's also animal protection, animal rights, and then maybe like long-termism, thinking about the long-term future as different cause areas. So initially very focused on global health, partly because that's like there's a lot of data there, and that's a very easy thing to kind of quantify and to like look at which charities are doing good, doing the most good. In any case, yeah, initially, early, it was quite focused on that. I think now it's more broadened into other cause areas. I mentioned animal protection, there's existential risk, and so on. So other cause areas. I think initially as well, I had quite a strong focus on earning to give as a something that someone can do. Earning to give is where you'd take a job based on its salary and not so much based on the kind of work you'd be doing. So the goal is to earn more money so that you can give that money to charities or to other people, for example, to do good work with.
And something like working in finance or something like that.
It could be finance. I mean, it could be anything. I guess someone could do anything to give, like in any role, I guess, as long as you have enough to give. But I think initially, like there, people were being encouraged to consider like finance jobs, as you say, like, or working in software development or something like, you know, those kind of like well-paying jobs, not necessarily known for like the most social impact in those industries. But to try, the goal would be to have more impact, by giving, giving your money. I think, over time that's shifted to people being more encouraged now to, go and do direct work themselves, working for an EA charity, I think partially this is because there's just more money in the movement as well. There's more funding available. Like a lot of people are doing earning to give. In the early days, there wasn't a lot of money. So I think that like was much more likely to be the best thing someone could do. More recently, I think there's a lot of other opportunities now. EA seems to be a little bit less funding constrained than it was in 2009.
Yeah.
So that's something that's changed. I think another one is initially as well, there was not much focus on systemic change. So systemic change versus, I guess you could say, like maybe just direct action or direct change. Direct change would be like giving anti-malarial bed nets to people in malaria-prone areas. And a systemic change in that same vein would be maybe changing like government policies or just kind of more like broader health interventions to try and like eliminate malaria as a problem.
Maybe like finding a vaccine, which I know that malaria
that's a good example.
Striving towards.
So some people might say like the malaria nets are more of a band-aid solution. So I think we're shifting away a little bit away from that. That was a criticism early in effective altruism. Partially this is because it's just kind of like systemic change is kind of hard to quantify. And when you have such a big focus on quantifying and like metrics to try and work out how much good you're doing, if something doesn't have, like if something is hard to quantify, you might kind of miss that. I mean, with systemic change, you still want to have like some kind of grounding for thinking that it's good. I mean, you can't just do the systemic change because you think it's good. You need some like some kind of rational argument for that at least. But in the absence of that, I think people just kind of didn't focus on that so much. I think more recently that's changing a little bit.
Definitely. And there's someone who works in impact and evaluation in the charity sector. I know that one criticism that people have had of EA was that they don't focus on systemic change, which I don't think is particularly, I think it was definitely a fair criticism back in the day, especially with like the kind of actions that EA were promoting. But I do think that there is more of that focus now. But like you're saying, you know, I work in impact and valuation, and it's a lot of things go into systemic change, like cultural shifts or whatever it might be, that are really, really difficult to measure. So you can understand why, if you are being driven by the data and there are almost like quick wins or simple actions that you can take that have a much more robust evidence base behind them to believe that you will be doing good. You can understand why the EAs went for those, especially at the beginning, as when they were more kind of funding constrained and trying to really kind of make
it. I like the term of like low hanging fruit. Some of the more direct action, and I think arguably we've like picked a lot of the low hanging fruit, and we've like, I mean, anti-malaria bed nets are, you know, in the early days, there was not much funding there, but now there's like so much funding in that space that you know, arguably, like, we've kind of, or I don't want to say like solve the problem, but it's less effective as it used to be, just because it's much less funding constrained. And now there's like, as we kind of pick the ball, low hanging fruit, now we start to get up higher to like bigger things like systemic change.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I first found out about EA about 5 years ago, it was around £2,000 to save someone's life with anti-malarial bed nets. And I think now it's around £3,000-£3,500 just because of the amount of, as you're saying, the amount of funding that has gone there.
Yeah.
The less good that you can do. Now, again, if your focus is saving human lives, £3,500 is still really, really cheap compared to, like treating someone for cancer or something like that, you know. If you really want to save human lives and that's your focus, malaria is still a good bet. But it's just an example about how the more money you throw at a problem, generally the less immediate good, or the more money or the more resources it will take to have as big an impact down the line. Yeah. And that's something that's key to the philosophy as well, is something around neglectedness.
If I could, that's a good segue to maybe talk about, like, I guess the three kind of pillars of effective altruism when you're thinking about like a cause, cause prioritization. So, or even prioritization of different charities. So we just talked about neglectedness. It's a general rule that as a problem or a charity becomes less neglected, it tends to be harder to make much impact in that area. And you can just think about that, like, we pick something like climate change, which probably still doesn't have as much attention as it should, but these days it's quite has quite a lot of money and attention in that area. Whereas if you think about getting involved in climate change, whether it's donating $1 million or like being involved with your career, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, that probably would have had a much bigger impact because there's so much less attention there. Whereas today, if you were to give $1 million, that's relatively much less impact. So that's neglectedness. The other two are scale, or just how big the problem is. Obviously, if a problem is really big, much more important to solve it versus if it's smaller. And the last one is tractability or solvability, maybe. It's just a measure of like how easy is it to do something about that problem. Because the problem could be really big and really neglected, but if it's just really hard to do anything about that problem, it's probably not worth actually working on. So if something checks all three of those boxes and you can kind of make trade-offs between them, then that's probably like a really important cause. Or you can do that for charities as well, as I said. That's probably like a very effective charity.
No, definitely. And now I can hear the objections saying, but Michael, I'm just really passionate about this one thing that's affected me personally. And you've come in and told me that there are better cause areas out there. Do you think that there is something that is... I mean, and again, I was going to ask next about like any of the positives or challenges or downsides presented by the philosophy. Do you think that that criticism of taking the, I don't know, the heart out of charity, about something about the EA approach being cold or unfeeling in a way, do you think that that criticism holds up?
Well, I think they are probably right in a sense that, you know, it is a little bit of a cold approach to charity or to charity or philosophy. But, you know, I don't think the victims care about how cold someone's approach to their, you know, reducing their suffering was. I mean, you know, they care about not suffering anymore or not having their rights taken from them. And I think, like to not help someone because, you know, doing so would be cold and rational, I don't think is a very sound argument. I mean, I understand that it can feel, it can just feel different, feel not as good. But I don't think that really holds up when you think about it in ethical terms, I guess.
Yeah. Intuitively, I do get it. Like, you know, if I just see on Facebook, for example, my friends who either aren't vegans or just not particularly interested in EA or whatever it might be, and the kind of things that they're raising money for, it tends to have that personal connection. And I've certainly done this in the past. And I wouldn't advocate going up to that person and saying, yes, I know that you are fundraising for British Heart Foundation because your loved one passed away from a heart attack. But did you know that if you've put that money towards stuff in factory farming, you know, and that is a straw man of the EA approach. EAs are not going around, as far as I can tell, and doing that to people. But I do get there is an intuitive case there, but I do feel that actually, if you're not focusing on the most impact, I think the criticism would go the other way. Like if I'm putting my emotional gratification or emotional state beyond the potential impact, then I feel like I'm neglecting those who I could be benefiting because for some reason the unfortunate situation they're in doesn't emotionally resonate with me. And that feels a bit cold.
Yeah.
You know, like to go back to the malaria example, living in the West, I will probably never meet anyone who's, certainly in a Western country, in the UK, for example, where we just don't have malaria at the moment. I might change with climate change, but we don't have it at the moment. Yeah. I'm unlikely to meet someone who will die of malaria, at least living in the UK, whereas I will meet and have met plenty of people who have contracted cancer and died of it. So it would, but that does, the fact that I tend to meet people who have or will develop cancer instead of malaria, that it would feel like a lack of empathy for me to say, and therefore that's what's important when I'm making the decision about what I should focus my time on or what I should give money towards. Yeah, and the problem I should try and solve. I happen to be close to this problem. Even though there's a much bigger problem over here, I'm going to focus on the one that is more immediate to me.
Yeah,
that feels a bit cold in the other way.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something Peter Singer talks about, where it shouldn't matter where someone is in the world in terms of how important their suffering is. Like if someone's on the other side of the world suffering, that suffering shouldn't be less important than someone suffering next to you. And it can certainly be hard to I guess embody that in your life and in your actions. It's certainly, you know, I think it's important to realize that, like, as much as I try to, I probably don't act perfectly. Like, you know, my brother's suffering is as important as like someone that's suffering on the other side of the world.
Yes.
You know, but I aspire to try and act like that, yeah, as much as I can.
And yeah. I was going to say, and within my own life as well, like our gratification systems, like what we as humans find rewarding or meaningful, they're not particularly attuned in many senses towards the most impactful solutions. So to go back to the example of me with the volunteering schemes, I had a lot of positive feedback while I was there. It was a really positive and meaningful experience while I was doing that volunteering. And just the other day, I inherited some money and donated it all to charities, like some of the EA recommended charities. And the amount of gratification I got from the weeks I spent volunteering around the world, significantly higher than me clicking donate on a website somewhere and watching these digits leave my bank account, even though the impact that I've had is, or I'm expected to have by making that donation, is orders of magnitude higher than the impact that I had through the volunteering. So yeah, I mean, it's just a point to say that in many ways you can't blame people for not taking the most impactful approach, or at least not finding the most impactful approach rewarding. Like, I think we can have some empathy towards that position because I've definitely felt it in my own life, but that doesn't mean that therefore we should ignore the impact. If anything, I think that means that we should try and create ways of rewarding ourselves for doing the impactful thing, such as, I don't know, joining a community where people really value donating to charity or using your career to work on neglected problems, something like that.
Yeah, definitely. And one more thing I want to say about, so you mentioned, like, if someone, you know, is really passionate about a particular cause, you wouldn't come up and tell them, have you thought about this other cause? But so somewhere where you obviously have to, you know, pick your time and place to say that. You don't say it when they're raising money for that charity. But like, I guess the way I think about it is the ultimate cause, or the thing that, you know, if someone is suffering because of cancer, it's not the cancer specifically that's the problem there. It's the suffering. And I think if you, like, sort of almost go up a level of cause, suffering comes in so many different forms, cancer being one, but if you're trying to just stop that suffering as much as possible, then there might be other ways to do that. And I don't know if that's necessarily a helpful way to, like, try and communicate that. I haven't really tested that myself, but if someone is, you know, very interested, very passionate about a particular cause, it might be worth trying to understand, like, why, what's their motivation, I guess, and maybe thinking about other ways that they can achieve that same goal with other causes.
Definitely. And that's definitely the approach I've taken towards veganism in the past. Mm. And I'm sure that it would for effective altruism, or at least just taking a more impact-driven approach to doing good. You find out that rather than saying your cause doesn't matter, you say, well, you know, it's great that you're so passionate about this. And then finding out what motivates that and saying, well, did you know that you could do even more good if you did this? Again, this is the kind of approach I'm taking with veganism. It does seem to go well. But as you said, you need to pick your moments.
Yeah.
Well, and how you frame your approach, it makes a big difference. If someone's raising money for a deceased relative, don't go in all guns blazing and tell them to donate something else instead.
Yeah.
But maybe, pick your time and then approach that person afterwards in a really kind of compassionate way. Mm-hmm. And you might be able to win them over. So if we're not convinced by the EA is cold objection, what would you say are the main kind of challenges or downsides presented by the philosophy or these ideas?
Yeah, I think we've talked about a few of them already. So like being like things like systemic change being harder to measure, which is just a downside of like being more evidence driven. I guess one challenge is as a philosophy, it's quite analytical, intellectual. It kind of appeals to a certain analytical mindset that not everyone has.
Mm.
So it might be hard for some people to really think about it, or for this to resonate with some people, depending on their approach to like thinking about these problems. So I guess maybe finding ways to communicate that in different ways that don't rely so much on like the analytical cost benefit analysis approach.
Yeah.
I think is like one of the main benefits of effective altruism, but it does have its downsides, and definitely. I'm not sure what the solution is there.
And as someone who doesn't have, I don't really have an analytical approach drilled into me, or not something that I was born very much, if you do any of the Myers-Briggs type personality types, very much on the feeler rather than the thinker side of things. So more emotionally driven than logically driven. I guess for me personally, I'm always trying to trick my automatic kind of emotional responses to try and be to end up at the logical conclusion. Like if you can be outraged or, you know, just move really passionate about the impact driven thing, it's hard to do. Like I think to some extent, I generally do believe that, like, while I think that the philosophy can be adopted by everyone, I don't think it's, you know, it's not like something that some people just aren't able to grasp or anything like that. I do think, as you said, that it does appeal to a certain mindset that for whatever reason some people have and others don't, and as someone in the don't category, like it can be difficult, as I say, just in terms of like motivation or passion, it can be difficult to take that kind of logical analytical approach, which, as you said, I think is one of the best parts of EA personally. Are there any other kind of challenges or downsides, would you say, of the philosophy that we haven't covered?
I'm sure there are, but nothing else is coming to me at the moment.
So we've talked about like EA as a philosophy or a set of ideas. I've got a few questions here about like EA as a community. So as someone who has never come across the EA community before, how would you kind of like describe them to an outsider?
I would like to make a point as well, just before I do that, that they are in many ways kind of separate. EA as a philosophy, EA as a community. I guess you could say the same thing about like a lot of things, like veganism as a philosophy versus veganism as a community.
Antinatalism, exactly. Really don't see spend a lot of time in many of the antinatalist community spaces for various reasons. But I tried to draw that separation there between the philosophy and the community.
Yeah, I think it's some people can sometimes get a bit caught up in, they disagree with the community, so they disagree with the philosophy, but they really are separate. I mean, you can disagree and not want to be a part of a community, but still hold the philosophy. I think there's a Absolutely. Two separate things. And the same, I mean, I know the same is for some people in EA. So EA as a community, though, I guess, well, so I think it's anyone who, like, who is an EA? I think it's anyone who, like, just identifies with the ideas of the, or the question of EA, as I put it earlier. So there's no one really is like dictating who is an EA. It's a little bit vaguer than, I guess, veganism as a community, because people might have some small disagreements, but generally speaking, people are, most vegans would agree on what a vegan is.
Yes.
I think it's a little bit harder to say what an EA is, because it's not like if you don't donate 10% of your income, then you're not EA. Like, no one, you know, there's like so many ways to do good that no one, it's like, it's hard. I think fundamentally it's just whoever like aspires to do good and wants to call themselves an EA is an EA. So it's quite like non-centralized. There's no like central like head charity or anything, for example, that's like kind of running things. I mean, there are charities like the Center for Effective Altruism that like try and take on like a bit of a community management role, but like it wouldn't, they're not, and they would agree that they're not like the head of EA or anything like that.
The EA so, overlords.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, there are some like, people who are quite influential in the early days of effective altruism, like Peter Singer, we mentioned, Will McCaskill being another one. Yeah. So I think, I'm sure they had a lot of influence in what EA is in the early days.
Definitely.
Then there are other, I mean, there are a lot of like, there are charities that either are like directly effective altruism in their mission, in that like, so for example, like Center for Effective Altruism, but then also Giving What We Can and The Life You Can Save. I'd say they're like very directly effective altruism, but then there's also like effective altruism aligned charities. So they're like, if a charity's mission is not necessarily to like promote the movement of effective altruism, but the work that they're doing is like very much in line with the EA philosophy, that people would call them like an aligned EA aligned charity.
Yeah. Would an example of that be like the Humane League, for example, being quite evidence driven, but not explicitly an EA charity?
Yeah definitely. Any charity that like just like a person can apply the EA philosophy, like a charity applying the EA philosophy to some extent. And then I guess like a lot of the way that people tend to like meet and exchange ideas in EA and socialize is like university and other local chapters. A lot of like university student run chapters for effective altruism, or Giving What We Can, or The Life You Can Save, being other like sort of EA kind of other brands, so to speak, or just like a different name for the chapters.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of people meet through like local chapters at universities and so on. Now, so I guess that means that like a lot of people who are directly involved in effective altruism tend to be like quite young, tend to be going to universities, and talk about, I want to talk about that a bit, maybe in a bit when we talk about some of the downsides or challenges.
Yes.
But then another way that people tend to meet is like forums and social media. I think there's a lot of like discussion of ideas. The EA forum is quite active, kind of a place that people look to for like, if you have an idea that you want to get feedback on about EA, you probably post it on the EA forum, and among other places. Or people have like their blogs and a lot of YouTube video channels and so on. So I think that's kind of like what the community looks like. I'm not sure if you had any other like questions about what EA or anything I've missed about EA as a community.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we've covered, so obviously like overview, some of the key players, definitely, as you said, like Will McCaskill, Peter Singer. What would you say are the main positives of the community?
Well, for me personally, I mean, it's just great to have like a like-minded community, people who think in a similar way to me, to be able to like meet with them and for sure to like work with and to exchange ideas with, but also just, I mean, some, you know, people that I've met through effective altruism have been and remain like some of my closest friends. They're just people who I feel so similarly to with and have such shared values with that. I mean, they're just like become like a big part of my life. So I'm sure for a lot of people, like just having that network and that community is really important to them. It's really motivating as well. I mean, if I didn't have those people around me, if I, you know, it had all the ideas I have about effective altruism, but I was on my own, it would be so much harder to motivate myself to keep working on this, I think.
Yeah.
Same with any community, veganism, antinatalism. If you have people around you who think similarly, or at least if you're able to like connect with them online, that can really help. So I think that's a huge positive.
Does that help with the meeting the basic needs that sometimes a cold analytical approach doesn't do, if that makes sense? So
yeah,
while definitely. It might not be obviously gratifying to, I don't know, set up a direct debit to charity, or when you're stressed at work and you've got a million deadlines, like a community around that is really supportive of people, you know, taking a big gamble with their career to do good, taking a stressful job, donating money, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That can kind of meet some of those needs.
Definitely. I mean, that's just another challenge of EA in general. Like it's people tend to be drawn to things that like give them the warm, fuzzy feeling. And, you know, generally that means something like someone, you know, like seeing the person that you're helping can really help with that. So typically that you don't really get that with the EA approach so much, but having that community, I mean, that does give you some of that, some of those benefits, I suppose. I mean, it's just a challenge that we have to think about, like people are just drawn to doing things that make them feel good. And that's kind of, I mean, that's just a reality and it makes sense. The community serves a role, I think, in helping to don't want to say combat, but combat that, I suppose.
Definitely. And one thing that I have noticed, again, mostly from the outside looking in at the EA community, is that there is much more of a norm within EA to be charitable towards people who you disagree with, and somewhere that people can test ideas that people might disagree with quite strongly, but still maintaining like a degree of empathy or compassion. And again, I don't think that this definitely isn't like a complete rule. Like EA, it's the same as anyone else, can fall foul and be, angry and bitter and tear each other down. But I've definitely noticed a lot less of that within EA compared to other movements, communities trying to do good in the world. Has that been your experience as well?
It has. I will say, I think that can sometimes go both ways. People are very often very happy to, have their ideas criticized and to be open-minded and think about, whether their idea might be wrong. But where that can sometimes go wrong is, people sort of like do the reverse of that, where they would like to provide feedback on other people's ideas. And if someone's not receptive to that feedback, that could be a little bit jarring, I suppose.
Interesting.
Like if someone is, very candid and willing to tell you that, some problems with your worldview and why, some downsides to the way that you're doing charity. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but I mean, people aren't always receptive to that. So, I think that's a really strong strength of EA, but it can go a little bit awry when someone maybe on the edge of EA is interested, but not so used to having their ideas challenged in that way.
Yes.
Even if people can be, even if it's done in like a respectful way, I don't think everyone's receptive to that necessarily.
Yeah. I've heard an example of where someone who was fairly new to EA or on the fringes went to like a conference, a big in-person event, and someone told them that speaking to them probably wasn't the best use of their time, kind of walked away.
That's,
that would be incredibly jarring. But then at the same time, I think you're in a conference and your approach is to maximize good. There's like a logical reason why you wouldn't want to spend your precious time talking with someone who you maybe didn't think it was the best use of time to speak to. But man, that would be tough to hear.
I don't think that describes like how most EAs would act.
No, I think that is like an extreme example of this logical approach to doing good. Like personal kind of, not decorum, but kind of like first, like social norms, I guess, around politeness.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that as a, I think that is more like of a one-off example. But I can understand why, as you're saying, that kind of people being very candid and being very direct, even if it's done in the kind way, if you're not used to that and you're coming into that space, that can be quite jarring. But that does lead nicely on to my next question, which is going to be around what are some of the main challenges or downsides, if you like, of the EA community.
Yeah, so I mentioned it a bit earlier that a lot of people involved in EA, a lot of people find out about it through university. So a lot of, I guess that's for like where people are open to new ideas, where there's a lot of communities and societies and so on. Like a lot of EA chapters have popped up in universities. But then I guess the downside is maybe a little bit of a problem with diversity.
Yes.
Not just of, I guess, things like race and gender, but also like class, I suppose. Like not everyone has access to university. So not everyone necessarily has the same access to like these ideas. So I think EA can come across as a little bit elitist sometimes, but not so in that regard. But then also, I think it's, this was a criticism along with the earning to give approach, sort of like saying that. Well, so someone might say like, "Oh, are you only saying that? Are you saying that effective altruism is only for like rich people? Only rich people can do good, or you can only do good if you have like money to give." I think that's a fair criticism. Of course, there's other things that people can do, like more directly with their career, like choice of career or other things that they do, like volunteering. But that can be a downside. I think it's also just a challenge with like growing the movement as well. I think I mentioned earlier, like the downside of the philosophy as well is like it's very analytical, and so it doesn't appeal to everyone who has that analytical mindset. But also I guess it doesn't we miss out like in different parts of the community because if someone is like not analytically minded or doesn't go to a university, I guess it's we haven't been able to tap into those communities as there's other like demographics as much, I suppose, with effective altruism. And I mentioned diversity. Partly because it's so prevalent at universities. Universities are a very select group of society already. And I think EA can like compound that a little bit. So EA is like relatively like male dominated, relatively like middle to upper class, relatively white. I think EA is doing better at this over time. And I think the Center for Effective Altruism is doing some work in like community health and, trying to like improve the diversity of the EA movement. Probably still some room to go though in that respect.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a criticism from the outside, and I have seen efforts to, as you're saying, like efforts to address that, and an open acknowledgement that this is a problem within EA is that lack of diversity, as you said, lack of diversity in lots of different aspects. I was wondering, just one thing that I've kind of observed a bit from the outside, and this is probably going to be poorly formulated, but it'd be good to see if this has been your experience as well. We were talking earlier about how, like EA is very like analytical and logic-driven approach. I wonder if sometimes with EAs, they almost like take the identity of someone who is, or like some EAs can take the identity of someone who's like logically driven or super rational, for example. I mean, this is more like with these explicitly the rationalist community, which is one which defines itself by being very rational. And if someone has an identity that's wrapped up in a certain trait, then any criticism of that trait can be perceived as quite negatively, or as an attack on someone's identity. So just to give an example, especially online, I've come across EAs justifying why they personally don't need to give to charity, or why they personally don't need to eat meat, stop eating animals or go vegan. And I've kind of felt like I'm looking at someone who has again, as we were saying before, kind of got the lifestyle that they would like. They identify as a logical person and then are convincing themselves that for logical reasons that they are making these choices, rather than kind of an acknowledgement that this is just the lifestyle that they would like, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess that ties into what we were talking about earlier with sometimes people can like post rationalize what they already are doing or what they already want to do.
Yes.
Is that kind of what you're getting at? Yeah.
Yeah. And in the community that really values rationality and reason, mm-hmm. I find that especially jarring. Like, mm-hmm. you know, when I see EAs, for example, that make excuses to why they personally don't, for example, take the giving what they can pledge for the 10%, or why, you know, what their work is just so important that they need to go skiing on their holidays and spend all that money there, or even, you know, my work is just so important, I can't even think about the animals in the factory. Any moment of me thinking about going vegan is a moment that is wasted on me stopping AI from killing everybody, that kind of thing. And I've come across quite a lot of that when people ask why EAs have made certain choices in their lives. And I find that especially jarring. And I wonder if that's because I come from the vegan community where there is very much an emphasis on you have to walk the walk. You clearly are a vegan or you're not. When I see the equivalent EA actions, or what I view of as the equivalent EA actions, which would be mostly around donating money to charity, but also going vegan, especially with a community based upon the, or at least initially inspired by Peter Singer. I find that especially jarring. And I find that especially jarring when there are, as you said, that post-rationalization afterwards as to why these decisions are made. But again, I think this is not really a criticism of EA as a movement and more something that I'm particularly sensitive to. But after that ramble, how does that relate to your experience within the community?
Yeah, so, I mean, I find it frustrating as well when someone, I mean, I do know many people who say something like this, that, you know, they can't go vegan because it's too hard and or it's, you know, their health would be at risk and not that important compared to like other things they're doing, you know, their like personal involvement in animal farming. And like, I guess it's tricky. I mean, this is like maybe a downside to like a very utilitarian movement where people can like, I mean, they're kind of right in a way that your personal involvement in like, let's say you have like an animal product once a week or something, that is like relatively small to some other good that you could do in the other direction with your career. But the part that's always frustrated me is that the two things don't seem to be like quite mutually exclusive. Like I do struggle even when someone's explained their rationale to really understand like how does being vegan really stop you from doing that work, or how does it harm your work? And I mean, even when I hear some of the examples, I just kind of like it. I guess I kind of get it in one sense because, you know, like I said earlier, it took me so long to become vegan just mostly because, like I thought it would be so much harder than it was.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's part of it in people would think it's harder than it is. And I get that for some people it's easier than for others. I mean, some people, you know, might like the taste of meat more than others. Like some people don't love it. I mean, I personally really enjoy the taste of meat. So yeah, like animal product alternatives would be a game changer for me. So I mean, yeah, it is frustrating, and I get it in a little bit, but I also like wonder if they're missing something when they're like using that as an excuse, I suppose.
While identifying as a rational person trying to that's the part that's jarring for me. It's not, you know, if I hear these excuses from my friend who doesn't care about EA or something like that, that's less grating to me than someone who explicitly says that they are being extremely rational, wants to do good in the world.
Yeah.
And then they have the same very similar arguments for why they personally eat animals or don't give money to charity.
Yeah.
Normans, if you like, would have.
Yeah, sure. One example you did give, though, I wanted to come back to, so you said skiing, they have to go skiing once a year.
Yes.
Like their work would be affected. That's a, you know, obviously that's bit of a, maybe a comical example, but there is something to be said for, I think, in finding the right balance of doing good and still having a life that, you know, you enjoy to avoid burnout. This one is really tricky because, so, I mean, there's obviously, you know, if someone like gave until it hurt, you know, they lived like really below their means, they may well burn out.
They probably might be impactful over the long term, as you said, because they would burn out.
But the tricky part, I guess, of that is where do you draw the line? And then people, there's a lot of wiggle room to justify, like, oh, I need two holidays in France skiing every year. Like, oh no, I actually need three holidays. Or, you know, like, it's hard to, I mean, there's probably some, there's definitely some amount of like small selfish acts that someone can do. Like taking holidays and like spending money on themselves. That is good and worthwhile in the long run. But the hard part is, deciding where, what the trade-off is. And I think people, you know, it's definitely something I struggle with. Maybe post-rationalizing the stuff you want to do. So
I struggle with that too, because I'm there thinking, okay, look, I would burn out. You know, my girlfriend lives in Germany. Obviously, it takes some time to go and see her. And then this part of me like, yeah, that seems justifiable to me to take time, use my annual leave to go and see her and have a good time there. But that doesn't, but then am I just justifying the life that I'd like? Like if I can think about working every minute of the day, I don't think, nearly nobody would say that, no, that's what you have to do. You are allowed to take some time to yourself. Then I think, should I take a 6-month, all expenses paid, cruise around the Caribbean that costs £50,000? And the answer is probably no. Like, if I'm there for 6 months going, I just need this 50K, all expenses paid cruise because of, you know, to recharge me to go back and do the good work. So somewhere in between those two extremes is like a sensible middle ground, but I don't know where that point is. And as you said, I don't think we ever will know. And so, as you said, we need to be mindful that we're not just justifying the life that we want to live while also recognizing that to be impactful for the long run, it's really important that you don't burn out, that you do look after yourself. It's a tricky one.
It is.
Great. So now we've got a few questions on like the relationship between EA and antinatalism. So how would you say that EA does or doesn't tie into antinatalism as a philosophy?
So I guess insofar as antinatalism is about reducing suffering, I think EA and antinatalism have like a lot of commonality. I think where antinatalists see a problem, I'm sure that applying the EA approach to that would be useful for them. So I think there is a lot of overlap. But while EA is usually is technically neutral to the ethical framework, as I've said, it's many EAs do tend to be classical utilitarian. This doesn't always have perfect overlap with the hard antinatalist view or like the person affecting view. Necessarily, so I think there is some disagreement with some in the EA community and probably the like what I'd call the like hard antinatalist, or probably what others would just call like regular antinatalist. The regular antinatalist view.
That it's always wrong to create new sentient beings. That would be like the hard antinatalist view.
And then the soft antinatalist is who coined this one? David Pearce.
Yes,
David Pearce says that soft antinatalism is, for all practical purposes, currently you think that procreating is wrong, but you don't think it's necessarily always wrong in the same way that other antinatalists might. You might, for example, think that like maybe in 200 years when we've fixed overpopulation, et cetera, it might be on the margin good to procreate, but at the moment it's not. So,
and if I'm right in thinking, yes, you're a soft antinatalist.
I would describe myself as, yes, probably like more of a soft antinatalist, yes.
And I would as well, even though I'm, okay, obviously hosting a podcast called Antinatalist, yeah, Advocacy. I'm very much thinking, okay, in this current context, in 2023, where we live, is it a good idea to bring new sentient beings into existence? And the answer I arrive at is a fairly overwhelming no, but not a no that could never be shifted by external circumstances. I'm not convinced by the ideas that it is always wrong to create sentient beings. And to be fair, I've never seen, well, he probably has, there's a decent chance he's been asked this, but certainly when I've heard David Benatar argue for antinatalism, he is talking, yep, about the current context. He's talking about human lives or the lives of sentient beings, you know, especially lives like farm animals, as they come into the world, as it exists now, contain quite a lot of bad. And yep, that is behind his antinatalist conclusion. So, yeah, I take the view that there could be a point where creating sentient beings could be a good idea. I'm just not convinced that it is right now, yeah, and not in my own life, for sure. And as you're saying, because of the utilitarian kind of approach rather than the rules-based approach to doing good, it feels like EA, which tends to take that more utilitarian approach and less of that rules-based approach, it wouldn't necessarily tie in with that hard, always wrong to procreate kind of philosophy.
Yeah, yeah. Example, I think, of this, we haven't really talked about existential risk or long-termism as like cause areas of effective altruism. So just to back up a little bit, like I've mentioned global health and animal protection, but some other cause areas are existential risk is the idea that there are potential catastrophic things that could occur, whether natural or man-made. So natural example might be asteroid impact or super volcano. Man-made example might be nuclear warfare, engineered pandemic, AI, for example. Things that people are worried about that could potentially end all human life or end all life on Earth. And the argument for why this is bad is because it eliminates like all the potential good that could come after that. I mean, if there's no more life, then there's no more life forever. You know, some people think that we have a lot of like potential to kind of expand and spread like happy lives throughout the cosmos. Not everyone in EA agrees with that per se, but I guess that's definitely something where an antinatalist might disagree, that, you know, existential risk is maybe not so bad, they might think, if all life became extinct tomorrow, let's say. I guess, but we're not, so I said that not everyone agrees with that. I guess because there's another, existential risk, but then also another aspect of long-termism, which is thinking about, the long-term future and, you know, considering lives, let's say lives 1,000 years from now being, just as morally worthy as like lives today.
Yes.
Another aspect of long-termism is S risk or suffering risks. So these are potential scenarios where like you could have just enormous amounts of suffering, more suffering than exists now on Earth, kind of spreading throughout the cosmos, for example. Like if let's say we spread wild animal suffering to other planets or factory farming to other, like to throughout the galaxy or something, like these sort of scenarios, it's hard, sometimes hard because they sound a little bit sci-fi-ish and it's because they don't really exist at the moment in such a grand scale. Sort of does rely on like a longer term kind of future technology. But these are probably some scenarios where people might say, well, it could be that like extinction is better than that scenario. And that's certainly a view I take. I think that life continuing is not necessarily going to be good. I think there's a lot of ways that it could be terrible, actually, on expectation.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
certainly when you get to colonizing the galaxy, the idea that is as much suffering that there is on the world in the world right now, and the two examples you gave of wild animal suffering and factory farming, both horrific. There's no reason why these couldn't spread throughout the galaxy as humans colonize the cosmos. And that would obviously be significantly worse than the situation that we find ourselves in right now, where it is just contained to Earth. And there's a really interesting discussion on this that, again, Lawrence has done a video on between Brian Tomasik and Magnus Vinding, which we will again linking in the description of this video. But yeah, sorry to bite.
No, that's, I think that's mostly what I had. I mean, I was just to summarize, I guess, like, yeah, I think there's a lot of overlap between EA and antinatalism. I think there's also some areas where some people in EA and some antinatalists would definitely disagree.
Absolutely.
But then for a lot of, I think, like, in the shorter term, I think for a lot of, like, practical purposes, you'd get more overlap than maybe in the longer term, kind of more theoretical kind of perspective. Like, for example, well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with hard antinatalism, but pretty much anything that, like, an antinatalist might advocate for in like a practical short-term view, I'd probably agree with. And like, I'm sure a lot of EAs would agree with as well. So yeah, I think that's where a lot of the overlap comes in.
Absolutely. And when Lawrence and I were building the website for antinatalist advocacy and linking the charities, there were just so many like EA aligned charities and just resources in general that really aligned, especially in terms of like practical next steps of what we can do. So EAs would support things like reproductive choice with some of our family empowerment media, opposing factory farming, wanting to do something about wild animal suffering, wanting to do something about potential AI suffering, which I know the Sentience Institute is focusing on a lot at the moment. So there is just a lot of overlap in the kind of tangible next steps or tangible steps that an individual can take that can maybe get lost, as you said, if we focus on the more theoretical kind of long-term stuff, which is extremely important, don't get me wrong, but yeah, I think that there are probably more areas of overlap than may meet the eye. And that leads on to my next question, which is going to be around like EA community attitudes towards antinatalism, and that's antinatalism both as a philosophy and then also like the antinatalist community. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think broadly, so first of all, I guess not a lot of EAs may probably know about antinatalism or are very familiar with it. I actually, don't know. I guess like antinatalism is like effective altruism, like still relatively new in people in like not a completely brand new idea, but like as a movement, still relatively new.
Yes,
and so. Yeah, I guess while there might be like in theory a lot of overlap, I think just because of a circumstance, not a lot of people do know about antinatalism.
Yeah,
I think, but then so I see like the three areas of effective altruism, antinatalism, and veganism. They all have a lot of overlap, and I definitely like do know quite a few people who are more so for veganism and antinatalism. I see that as having like a stronger overlap out of the three.
Yeah.
A lot of vegans I know are antinatalist. And actually the other way around, I'd say like most antinatalists I know are vegan is the more accurate one.
Yes.
In theory, effective altruism I think should have a lot of overlap with antinatalism. I think it just happens that like not a lot of people are really very strongly familiar with the ideas of antinatalism or don't know much about it yet.
Yeah, and that's why I was asking those questions at the beginning about when you kind of found out about those philosophies, because I've now met a few people in the antinatalist community who've had like a similar experience of kind of finding out about those three and in whichever order and like being attracted to the overlaps between the three. I think interestingly though, when we do get to some of those theoretical like the long-term disagreements there is where there is that kind of conflict, I have come across, again, it's a case of like going and searching for it, so it's not like this immediately jumps out at you as soon as you enter an EA space. I have found some quite strong disagreement between antinatalism and even some of the leading lights in EA like Will McCaskill, Toby Ord, who's another philosopher who helped form EA with Will McCaskill. He was very much interested in this long-termist idea of protecting the long-run future. And I think that there potentially is, as you were saying, like within the EA community, that many EAs aren't familiar with these ideas, or maybe you've heard about these ideas only through a criticism of them from people who you know, quite strongly disagree with them in the long term sense. Do you reckon that there is a role for antinatalists to become more, or to get more involved in the EA community and start kind of normalizing these ideas or spreading them in a way?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, I guess in the same way that maybe like a vegan who has heard about effective altruism, there's some value in like them becoming more involved, normalizing like veganism within EA. And vice versa, actually, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah, like EA is becoming involved in the vegan movement and maybe like talking about how to help animals more effectively, or effectively, you know, do that. Yeah, like how to maybe do like advocacy more effectively, thinking about like evidence. Yeah, so I think there's, well, all three, I think there's value in, yeah, trying to be involved in all three. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Definitely. And without blowing our own trumpet, like Lawrence and I definitely had these kind of ideas when we were thinking of antinatalist advocacy and certainly going through the website, where hopefully the overlaps are not too, they're not hidden. They're quite overt that, yeah. And trying to produce something or create a space at least where anyone from, I was going to say anyone from the communities, but really anyone who's interested in these ideas. And that's maybe something as well that maybe a mindset that would be good to move away from is this idea of like you're within a community or you're within one group or tribe. And I noticed that I've been doing it throughout the interview saying, oh, like as an outsider to the EA community. And I'm there thinking, well, I've taken the given what we can pledge and I'm trying to use 80,000 hours career advice in my career. So there's not like a hard kind of defining line. I think maybe, you know, I grew up in a Christian family and the vegan community has some kind of overlaps at times with like a religious kind of movement that maybe I do have that kind of you're within this community or you're not kind of approach that maybe we want to move away from. But yeah, I would definitely echo that. I would definitely encourage people of all communities. I think that they all really do have something to offer and more overlap between the three, I think would definitely be a good thing.
Hmm.
Well, great. Was there anything, of course, we covered quite a lot today and apologies for jumping around quite a bit in this interview as well. But was there anything else that you wanted to cover today that we haven't already covered?
Yeah. So, I think one of my still biggest, reasons for not procreating myself, in addition to like the antinatalist philosophy is, I guess the opportunity cost, and I think this would be an overlap between antinatalism and effective altruism. Like having a child is like a massive cost, both monetarily and on your time and energy. So for me in Australia, and I did go kind of do an estimate, it would cost about $500,000 on average to raise one child where I live. So I mean that's a huge cost that could be. We talked about the, you know, how cheaply you can save a life through like antimalarial bed nets or some other way. You know, that's like potentially hundreds of lives that I could be saving rather than just having one child. So, I mean, that's like a really big motivation for me. In terms of like thinking about what, you know, even if I did want kids for selfish reasons, could I justify it knowing that? I guess it can always say, post-rationalization, yes. but for what it's worth, like I don't think I could justify it. Not to mention the time and energy that I know I'd not have, and then not be able to do as much good in my spare time, or through my career even. So yeah, I think that's something that, probably EAs and antinatalists could both get on board with.
Definitely. I did the same calculations actually in the UK. So like a low figure in the UK, a low ballpark figure is £210,000 to raise a kid.
Yep.
And a high ballpark figure, just if you were focusing on anti-malarial bed nets, like saving human lives, like if you use that £3,500, then you could save 60 lives for the cost of creating one kid who didn't ask to be here, you know, that doesn't have any needs to meet of their own. For me to create someone and meet their needs, I could have saved 60 lives of someone, you know, of people who do exist right now and are suffering and will, you know, potentially die or would die if I didn't donate that money. Mm. And that is just focusing on saving human lives. Potentially, if you, by donating to things like, you know, the most effective factory farming charities, you can scale up and do just a huge amount of good with all that money. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely the money point, also the time point as well. Like, you know, having children is very difficult. Now, obviously, it's rewarding in other ways, but especially in the early stages, like having children could be, you know, quite energy sapping and a really big burden. Like, no, any parent will tell you that having kids is not easy.
Yeah.
And so, if you really are looking to do good in the world, just sitting down and, as you said, like almost like running the math, just calculating is, in terms of your time, resources, but also your energy, can you be doing so much more good by not choosing to procreate? And the answer in just about every case, maybe some very fringe hypotheticals that I can think of, like you knew that your kid would be the one who would cure cancer or whatever it would be. You know, people have grand ideas of what their kids are going to achieve. In just about every real world scenario, the answer is that you could probably just do a tremendous amount more good with the resources for those beings who either do currently exist, or in the case of something like factory farming and this reliance with antinatalism, by stopping beings from coming to existence who would live truly terrible lives, you can just do so much good by not procreating. And that is definitely one of the EA related reasons why I first became interested in antinatalism, for sure. So we talked about some of the things that you're working on with the Sentience Institute. Are there any other kind of projects or anything else you'd like to shout out? Maybe something from the Vegan Space Scientist YouTube channel?
Oh, sure. Well, just from the first, from the Sentience Institute perspective, I think something that probably a lot of your listeners would find useful to know about is, so we've pivoted to doing, historically Sentience Institute has been more focused on animal protection. We've pivoted a little bit recently to looking more at digital minds. So both people's attitudes towards digital minds, AI, if and when they become sentient. But also, how do we protect the interests of sentient digital minds if and when they come about? I think that's, you know, it's worth, even if there are no sentient digital minds at the moment, it's worth thinking about that problem now so we can try and like either stop them from happening or make sure their interests are in a good place when they come about. So
absolutely. I was gonna say that's something that Lawrence talked about, comparing like artificial sentences, digital minds compared to, you know, animals, human and non-human animals, is that when human and non-human animals come into existence, it's like a gestation period. There's like some stuff that needs to happen. It's quite an onerous process, but just imagine we could just, as easy as it is to copy and paste some Word files, just be creating all of these digital minds. And as well, like, and again, you'll be able to explain this better than I can, but in the same way that a pocket calculator is millions of times more efficient than you are at processing mathematics equations, can just calculate things so much better. It's not impossible that a digital mind could process and experience the negative feelings of suffering in ways that humans and non-human animals are constrained by.
I think that definitely
ties into your point around S risks as well.
For sure. Yeah, that's one I didn't mention when I gave some examples of like factory farming and wild animal suffering spreading. But I mean, it would probably be so easy for a digital mind to reproduce. As you said, it's absolutely, like it probably wouldn't be much more complicated than like copy pasting. So, I mean, once you get that on like a cosmic scale, that's quite terrifying, especially if they're leading lives of like a lot of suffering, or if we're like exploiting digital minds like on a mass scale to, you know, as a workforce, but we're, you know, giving them no rights and similarly to how we have factory farming. So I think this is something that antinatalists should be at least aware of and thinking about. Because it is a new potential source of like procreation in a sense. And so some people like the philosopher Thomas Metzinger, they're advocating for like a moratorium on the development of artificial sentience. I think like probably people who follow the antinatalist perspective probably wouldn't disagree with that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
And then you mentioned my YouTube channel. Yes. Vegan Space Scientist. So I do a lot of different videos in there, mostly like talk about philosophy or science, do like explainer videos. I'm a vegan and I'm a space scientist by trade. So that's where the name comes from. So I've got some space videos there, but also just like science, skepticism, and yeah, a whole bunch of different things. Really kind of just whatever I feel like talking about at the time. But yeah, a lot of different things. Maybe something would be interesting there. Antinatalism as well. Talking about like my experience getting a vasectomy and some other stuff.
And also your podcast, which I think has got such a great title, Morality is Hard.
Oh, and thank you.
It really touches on the fact that it's really difficult. Like, like figuring out just this fundamental question of what is the right thing to do in any one moment. It can be really tough. I think that podcast really speaks to that.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Sadly, I've parked that project for now. I haven't had time to work on that in a few years. The motivation for the name was, it's just really hard to work out what the right thing to do is. And I guess I tried to talk about try and like break that down, maybe with some specific examples. All the episodes are still online if anyone wants to see.
Yeah, definitely. Please go and check those out if you're interested, because they're really, really great conversations.
Oh, thanks.
Great. How can people follow you, get in touch, just figure out what you're doing?
Yeah, the best way in general is probably just to look at my website, michaeldeller.com, blog, and also I have some other stuff that I work on there. Or I'm not super active on social media at the moment, but sometimes I am. Twitter, my handle, I think, is I've actually forgotten it, to be honest. I think it's Michael Deller. maybe I'll message you after and if you want to put that there. Or my YouTube channel. I think those are the three best ways.
Right, sounds good. And then one thing I try and do with these podcasts, understandably, like antinatalism can be seen as quite a depressing or pessimistical down philosophy and community. So I always try to end this podcast on a positive note. So what would you say is something kind of like antinatalism related that you're feeling particularly positive about at the moment?
I guess one thing that I like to think about, and this is not just really an antinatalist positive thing, but maybe for effective altruists in general as well, like things are generally getting better in a lot of ways, like a lot and across a lot of like important metrics, like childhood mortality is going down year on year for the last 100 or so years. Global extreme poverty is down. A lot of things that I guess like some of these are like motivations for antinatalism or kind of tie into like population growth. But I guess even though the world population is still going up, like in a lot of other perspectives, like childhood mortality going down, I think is good. That one can be, of course, a bit counterintuitive sometimes. You might think like, well, if childhood mortality is going down, does that mean population growth is going up? But typically where we see child mortality go down, it actually reduces population growth. Long story short, because people if childhood mortality is very high, people tend to have more children to make sure that there are enough children alive to like take care of them when they're older. So you might have, if there's a 20% chance of your children might die, you might have five to make sure at least one or two survive. But if there's like a 99.9% chance your children will survive, like there is in Australia where I'm lucky enough to live, population growth tends to go down in countries that go in that direction, because you don't need to have as many kids. So these things, like these are improving globally slowly over time, and that's that'll affect population growth. So I'm sure antinatalists can take that as a win.
Definitely, and that is something, as you said, that might be quite counterintuitive, but just from an antinatalist perspective, like, you know, fewer sentient beings being brought into existence, and those that do come into existence living better lives than they otherwise would have done. So that's definitely a positive thing. Thanks so much again for coming on, Michael, and thanks so much for your work as well.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it, and then you too.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Thank you to you as well, listeners, for tuning in.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. To find out more about AA, including careers advice, donation recommendations, and different ways to get involved, you can go to our website at www.antinatalistadvocacy.org. To keep up to date with what we're up to, feel free to subscribe to our monthly newsletter and follow us on your favourite social media platforms. Links to all of the above are in the description. As always, we are hoping you will join us in our Antinatalist Advocacy.